actual safety and security. The media continued to roll out its beloved perfumed princes, the David Petraeuses and Wesley Clarks, its warrior monks like Jim Mattis and H.R. McMaster, or its retreads, the former analysts and leaders whose track records were so miserable that there is not one county in the Middle East that is safer today than it was 18 years ago, as they preach the doctrine of perpetual war. Arkin tweeted, "For me, I realized how out of step I was when I looked at Trump's various bumbling intuitions. His desire to improve relations with Russia, to denuclearize North Korea, to get out of the Middle East, to question why we are fighting in Africa, even in his attacks on the intelligence community and the FBI. Of course, he is an ignorant and incompetent imposter. And yet I'm alarmed at how quick NBC is to mechanically argue the contrary, to be in favor of policies that just spell more conflict and more war. Really? We shouldn't get out of Syria? We shouldn't go for the bold move of denuclearizing the Korean Peninsula? Even on Russia, though we should be concerned about the brittleness of our democracy that is so vulnerable to manipulation, do we really yearn for the Cold War? And don't even get me started with the FBI. What? We now lionize this historically destructive institution?" Military planners decided to exploit the growing tensions between the U.S. and Russia to justify further troop deployments and greater defense spending, as they had done throughout the Cold War. In April 2016, Lieutenant General H.R. McMaster and three other top Army officers issued a dire prognosis of America's military capabilities and their effect on national security to the Senate Armed Service Committee. McMaster wanted to send more troops to Europe, a position endorsed by Air Force General and NATO Supreme Commander Philip Breedlove. One senior Pentagon official dismissed the tired and oft-told tale of American military weakness. "This is the Chicken Little sky is falling set in the Army. These guys want us to believe the Russians are 10 feet tall." There's a simpler explanation. The Army is looking for a purpose and a bigger chunk of the budget. And the best way to get that is to paint the Russians as being able to land in our rear and on both of our flanks at the same time. What a crock. Military analyst Mark Perry also thought the military weakness argument absurd and offered the following breakdown. "The United States spends 7 times the amount of money on defense as Russia, $598 billion versus $84 billion, has nearly twice the number of active duty personnel, 1.4 million versus 766,000, and just under 6 times as many helicopters, approximately 6,000 versus 1,200, 3 times the number of fighters, 2,300 versus 751, and 4 times the total number of aircraft. We have 10 aircraft carriers. The Russians have 1. And while it's true that the Russians field nearly twice the number of tanks as the U.S., 15,000 versus 8,800, their most recent version, the T-14 Armata, broke down during the 2015 Moscow May Day parade. America's M1A1 tank, on the other hand, has never been defeated in battle. Ever. By 2018, the United States was actually spending 12 times as much on defense as Russia. Trump's 2018 increase alone was more than Russia's entire military budget. And Perry's comparison would have been far more lopsided if he had taken into account total U.S. military spending, which would also include intelligence, homeland security, veterans benefits, and Department of Energy expenditures. In late March 2016, the Army dignified the assertions of American weakness and announced plans to send another brigade of U.S. troops to Europe. Retired Lieutenant Colonel Daniel Davis scoffed at this escalation, insisting it would just give Putin an excuse to spend more money on his own military. "This is all very predictable. He'll up the ante and the Army will say, 'See, we don't have enough troops, so here we go again.'" But in June 2016, NATO announced a major deployment of 4 additional battalions to Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia, and Poland, led by the U.S., Britain, Germany, and Canada. British Defense Secretary Michael Fallon believed this would send a very strong signal of our determination to defend the Baltic states and Poland in the face of continued Russian aggression. The deployment consisted of over 4,500 troops. This was in addition to existing U.S. plans to send a 4,000-person armored brigade and heavy equipment, which arrived in Germany in January 2017 and began rotations around Eastern Europe. It was NATO's biggest military buildup since the end of the Cold War. Russia angrily condemned this escalation of the conflict and deployed thousands of its own troops along its western border with Europe. In October, the U.S. deployed its 2nd Cavalry Regiment to the Polish NATO outpost, located only 100 miles from Kaliningrad. Russia also complained about U.S. ballistic missile defense systems being set up in Poland and Romania. In June 2016, Russian historian Gilbert Doctorow had correctly noted, "The risk of accidental war has moved quickly beyond where it was just 18 months ago. Now we are entering upon implementation of very provocative U.S.-directed military expansion of NATO activities at the borders of Russia." Doctorow singled out ongoing war games codenamed Anaconda 16 in Poland, numbering 31,000 troops, 17,000 of them Americans, which, he reported, are rehearsing a NATO seizure and occupation of Russia's Kaliningrad enclave, just a few miles away. Putin responded angrily that any incursion into Russian territory would be met with a nuclear attack, not only on Europe but also on the United States, a threat as stupid and reckless as the ones the U.S. repeatedly made toward the Soviet Union during the Cold War, and has persisted in making toward Russia and others since. With Trump in office, tensions continue to ratchet up. In March 2018, Curtis Scaparotti, the top U.S. general in Europe, told the Senate Armed Services Committee that U.S. and allied ground forces in Europe are outmatched by Russia. Scaparotti, who headed the U.S.-European Command and served as the supreme allied commander in Europe, sounded Reagan-esque in concurring with H.R. McMaster's 2016 assessment that U.S. forces were outranged and outgunned by their Russian counterparts. He painted an alarming picture of Russian aggression in Europe and beyond, and contended that the Russian military is improving and modernizing its capabilities, enhancing its ability to be a more agile force capable of executing operations across the entire spectrum of modern warfare. Scaparotti's alarming testimony came on the heels of an even more alarming report by the RAND Corporation, which concluded that if fighting broke out in Eastern Europe, Russia, with its superior firepower, would overwhelm NATO forces in the Baltics and use brinksmanship to attempt to freeze the conflict. The report's authors make clear that there is nothing to suggest that Russia is contemplating such action, but, like General Scaparotti, urged enhanced spending to bolster NATO forces and improve readiness. According to the RAND researchers, Russia has 78,000 troops in the region and 757 tanks. NATO has 32,000 troops and 129 tanks. The Stockholm International Peace Research Institute reported that when Putin took office in 2000, Russia spent $20.9 billion on its military, which represented 3.6% of its GDP. In 2016, Russia spent $70.3 billion, or 5.3% of its GDP. Expenditures declined to $66.3 billion in 2017, which was 4.3% of GDP, placing Russia far behind China's $228 billion, and even behind Saudi Arabia's $69.4 billion. Russian leaders announced goal is to cut defense spending below 3% of GDP within 5 years, creating an even greater imbalance with the free-spending U.S. Despite U.S. exaggeration of the Russian threat to justify outlandish levels of military spending, Russian capabilities had improved so dramatically in recent years that former Soviet naval officer and current military analyst Andrei Martyanov argued in his 2018 book, Losing Military Supremacy, The Myopia of American Strategic Planning, that Russia had not only developed a capable new generation of nuclear weapons, but matched or surpassed the U.S. in electronic warfare capabilities, air defense systems, command, control, and communications, and surveillance and reconnaissance. This gave Russia the capability to challenge and defeat the U.S. in a conventional confrontation, helping explain its increasing willingness to stand up to the U.S. in Syria and Ukraine. In August 2016, Russia held a Collective Security Treaty Organization training operation in its Pskov Oblast. Participants included Kazakhstan, Armenia, Belarus, Kyrgyzstan, and Tajikistan. It was the first such military exercise along the border with NATO, in this case Estonia and Latvia. Thus, relations between the U.S. and Russia had frayed badly even before allegations began to surface that Russians were interfering in America's 2016 presidential elections. That year's presidential race was one of the most outlandish, controversial, and consequential in American history. It pitted Hillary Clinton, the hawkish and centrist, though experienced, former First Lady, Senator, and Secretary of State, against Donald Trump, a political novice who had gained fame as a self-promoting New York real estate mogul turned reality TV star. There was much in his background to sink the thrice-married, overweight blowhard, whose father had been arrested at a Ku Klux Klan-started riot in 1927. Donald Trump had taken out full-page ads in all four major New York newspapers, calling for the death penalty for five black teenagers, labeled the Central Park Five in 1989, for raping and attempting to murder a young white female jogger in New York Central Park. Despite proclaiming their innocence, the young men were convicted and served between 6 and 13 years in prison before the real perpetrator stepped forward and confessed his guilt. More recently, Trump waged a 2-year campaign alleging that Barack Obama had not been born in the United States as he claimed, and was therefore ineligible to be president. That effort ended for the most part when Obama produced his Hawaii birth certificate. The unifying element between the two incidents was a deep-seated racism and bigotry, factors that lay at the heart of Trump's campaign and presidency. Both candidates eked out difficult primary victories on the road to winning the respective party's nomination. Clinton withstood a serious challenge from Vermont Independent Senator and self-proclaimed socialist Bernie Sanders. Sanders, whose advocacy of a single-payer health plan, cancellation of student debt, redistribution of wealth, and other progressive measures lit a fire under young voters, in a way Obama's initial candidacy had, came from nowhere to almost overtake the establishment-backed Clinton. Sanders accused Clinton of having close ties to Wall Street, declaring in one of the televised debates, "What being part of the establishment is in the last quarter having a super PAC that raised $15 million from Wall Street." CNN reinforced this image, reporting in February 2016 that since Bill Clinton had left office in 2001, he and Hillary had earned more than $153 million in speaking fees, averaging more than $210,000 per speech. Among those were at least 39 speeches to big banks. Sanders repeatedly demanded that Clinton release the transcripts of her Wall Street speeches. His criticism resonated with voters, but Democratic Party officials put their thumb on the scale to make sure that Clinton won her share of the primaries and retained the overwhelming support of non-elected superdelegates. Clinton ultimately prevailed but was badly damaged in the process. Trump, running a very different campaign, emerged triumphant from a field of 17 Republican candidates. He differentiated himself by his hyper-nationalist America First ideology and willingness to insult, belittle, ridicule, mock, and bully his opponents. His gutter campaign would carry over into the presidential race. It was a style of campaigning for which neither Clinton and the Democrats, nor Trump's Republican primary opponents, were adequately prepared. Many took sharp offense at both the tone and the content of Trump's candidacy. In March 2016, 50 senior Republican Party foreign policy experts, many of whom had cheered on George W. Bush's own reckless foreign interventions, issued a scathing statement repudiating candidate Donald Trump, They wrote, "From a foreign policy perspective, Donald Trump is not qualified to be president and commander-in-chief. Indeed, we are convinced that he would be a dangerous president and would put at risk our country's national security and well-being. Most fundamentally, Mr. Trump lacks the character, values, and experience to be president. He weakens U.S. moral authority as the leader of the free world. He appears to lack basic knowledge about and belief in the U.S. Constitution, U.S. laws, and U.S. institutions, including religious tolerance, freedom of the press, and an independent judiciary. In our judgment, Mr. Trump is unable or unwilling to separate truth from falsehood. He does not encourage conflicting views. He lacks self-control and acts impetuously. He cannot tolerate personal criticism. He has alarmed our closest allies with his erratic behavior. All of these are dangerous qualities in an individual who aspires to be president and commander-in-chief, with command of the U.S. nuclear arsenal. We are convinced that in the Oval Office, he would be the most reckless president in American history." That Trump's brand of populism with its quasi-fascist undertones would appeal to the Republican base should not be a surprise. Mindful of the gains made by the civil rights and women's movements, the erstwhile Party of Lincoln had long been tailoring its message of ethnic and racial bigotry to white men who felt marginalized by the advances of peoples of color and women. Where others had been more subtle, Trump openly inveighed against Mexican rapists, Muslim terrorists, free-riding Asians and Europeans, globalists who sacrificed U.S. jobs and trade to foreign competitors, creatures of the Wall Street obeisant D.C. swamp, and lazy blacks who were responsible for their own squalid living conditions. But there was also a part of Trump's message that made sense. Trump called for a new foreign policy that finally learns from the mistakes of the past, and said, "We will stop looking to topple regimes and overthrow governments." He promised to partner with any nation that is willing to join us in the effort to defeat ISIS and radical Islamic terrorism. "In our dealings with other countries, we will seek shared interests wherever possible and pursue a new era of peace, understanding, and goodwill." U.S. policy toward the Middle East, he rightly noted, had done a tremendous disservice not only to the Middle East, we've done a tremendous disservice to humanity. The people that have been killed, the people that have been wiped away. "And for what?" he asked. "It's a mess. The Middle East is totally destabilized, a total and complete mess. I wish we had the $4 trillion or $5 trillion. I wish it was spent right here in the United States on schools, hospitals, roads, airports, and everything else that are all falling apart." Trump was particularly unsparing when it came to the U.S. invasion of Iraq. On February 17, 2016, he told the audience at a town hall event in Bluffton, South Carolina, "I tell the truth about Iraq. I say the war was a disaster. We spent $2 trillion, lost thousands of lives, thousands of lives. We have wounded warriors all over the place. We should never have been there. It's one of the worst decisions in the history of the country. We have totally destabilized the Middle East." Trump pointed out the obvious truth that Iran was the big winner. "Now Iran is taking over Iraq. Just as sure as you're sitting there. We don't even have anything to do with Iraq anymore. We're gone. But think of it. We spent $2 trillion. Could have rebuilt our country. We could have done so much with that money. And instead, we're worse in the Middle East than we were 15 years ago. Right now, it's a disaster." Perhaps most troubling to the foreign policy establishment in both parties was Trump's views on Russia. In his first major foreign policy address, in April 2016, he stated, "We desire to live peacefully and in friendship with Russia and China. Russia, for instance, has also seen the horror of Islamic terrorism. I believe an easing of tensions and improved relations with Russia from a position of strength only is possible. Absolutely possible. Common sense says this cycle, this horrible cycle of hostility must end, and ideally will end soon. Good for both countries." In June, he asked, "Wouldn't it be nice if we actually got along with Russia? Wouldn't that be good? Alongside his eagerness to improve relations with Russia, was Trump's dismissal of NATO as an obsolete relic of the Cold War. In March 2016, he told Fox News, "We're dealing with NATO from the days of the Soviet Union, which no longer exists." Clinton, on the other hand, approached the election as a coronation. Intellectually and experientially, she was head and shoulders above her Republican opponent. She appealed to women who were eager to elect the country's first female president, something that was long overdue. But she carried a lot of baggage that ultimately undermined her candidacy. She had advocated the invasions of Afghanistan, Iraq, and Libya, as well as the bombing of Syria, and a confrontational stance toward Russia and China, making her toxic to many Democratic and some libertarian-leaning voters, who hungered to see the United States play a different role in the world. She was not a natural campaigner, exuding little warmth or charisma. She ran a one-dimensional campaign blasting Trump, but offering little positive for voters to latch onto, especially in crucial Rust Belt states such as Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania, which she lost by a combined 80,000 votes, ultimately costing her the election. Most tellingly, her past foibles coincided perfectly with the areas in which she should have been capable of exploiting Trump's most glaring vulnerabilities. Trump, a high-rolling, loophole-exploiting, bankruptcy-prone billionaire, always happy to use other people's money, was able to paint Clinton as the hated, avaricious Wall Street toady who was paid $225,000 per speech by Goldman Sachs and surrounded herself with Wall Street insiders. Trump, who had gone bankrupt several times, repeatedly stiffed those who worked for him, found it impossible to get loans from U.S. banks, and refused to release his tax returns, portrayed Clinton as the corrupt one, because of the machinations of the Clinton Foundation and her husband's selling of the Lincoln bedroom to wealthy donors. Her past defense of her husband's philandering and attack on his accusers as bimbos compromised her ability to effectively attack Trump when an Access Hollywood tape appeared in which he bragged about assaulting women and grabbing them by the pussy, or when a dozen women came forward to accuse him of sexual assault. It was actually Trump who put Clinton on the defensive for her vote for the Iraq War. It was Trump whose attack on globalization and one-sided trade deals forced Clinton to denounce NAFTA, her husband's signature trade accomplishment. It was Trump, not Clinton, who appealed to blue-collar workers and those who were dissatisfied with the status quo after decades of economic stagnation. It was Trump who talked about improving relations with Russia and reigning in NATO. But it was also Trump who fanned the flames of ethnic and racial bigotry and misogyny, and stirred up the ugliness and resentment of white males who felt that they had been losing out to immigrants, women, and minorities as their higher-paying jobs disappeared, many going to cheap labor markets overseas, and their social status declined. Clinton had already been damaged by FBI Director James Comey's July 5, 2016 announcement that the Justice Department had investigated her use of a private email server during her tenure as Secretary of State, but had decided not to press charges, despite finding Clinton and her aides extremely careless in their handling of classified information. On July 22nd, during the Democratic Convention, WikiLeaks published its first batch of Democratic Party emails. Then, on October 7th, within 30 minutes of the release of the Access Hollywood video, WikiLeaks began posting a new batch of emails from Clinton campaign chairman John Podesta. The release would continue over the next month and total more than 20,000 pages of sometimes extremely embarrassing information about the inner workings of the campaign and related topics. The leaked emails revealed campaign officials' worries about Clinton's close ties to Wall Street, support for NAFTA and the TPP, obsession with secrecy, use of a private email server, sometimes terrible political instincts, and preferential treatment of donors to the Clinton Foundation, as well as strategies for undermining the Sanders candidacy, advocacy of covert actions overseas, and other damaging revelations, including the contents of her speeches to Wall Street banks. Particularly troubling was her statement that politicians need both a public and private position on issues, which fed into the narrative of her untrustworthiness, Then, on October 28th, 11 days before the election, Comey announced that the FBI had reopened the investigation into Clinton's emails as a result of discoveries during its investigation into the conduct of disgraced former New York Congressman Anthony Weiner, whose wife, Huma Abedin, was a very close Clinton advisor, and with whom he had shared a computer. On the eve of the voting, November 6th, Comey announced that, once again, he had decided criminal charges were unwarranted. But the damage had been done. Clinton supporters cried foul. Others were also aghast at Comey's behavior, insisting that it was unheard of for an FBI director to reveal the existence of an ongoing investigation, especially into a matter so sensitive and in so ill-timed a manner. Even more than the revelations in the Podesta emails, Comey's announcement played perfectly into the Trump campaign's allegations about crooked Hillary and the need to drain the swamp and lock her up. Still, virtually no one, with the notable exceptions of historian Alan Lichtman and filmmaker Michael Moore, predicted a Trump victory. The nation was shocked when Trump carried such heavily blue-collar northern states as Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin, and despite losing by 3 million in the popular vote, won the Electoral College by 304 to 227. The repercussions of the Trump victory have roiled the United States and the rest of the world ever since. In the U.S., liberal and mainstream media and congressional investigators have been fixated on the role played by Vladimir Putin and his allies in assisting Trump's election. That most Russians preferred Trump, there is little doubt, though Putin remained neutral during the campaign and would certainly have had misgivings about Trump's temperament. When Trump's victory was announced, members of the Russian parliament toasted with champagne. When later asked why he and other Russian officials so strongly backed the election of the vulgar, narcissistic, buffoonish figure, one leading member of the Russian Senate answered, "For one reason and one reason alone. Donald Trump said he wanted to be friends with Russia." In early January 2017, three of America's 17 intelligence agencies issued a report declaring with high confidence that Russian President Vladimir Putin ordered an influence campaign in 2016 aimed at the U.S. presidential election. Russia's goals were to undermine public faith in the U.S. democratic process, denigrate Secretary Clinton, and harm her electability and potential presidency. We further assess Putin and the Russian government developed a clear preference for President-elect Trump. The report also charged that Moscow's influence campaign followed a Russian messaging strategy that blends covert intelligence operations, such as cyber activity, with overt efforts by Russian government agencies, state-funded media, third-party intermediaries, and paid social media users or trolls. More specifically, it reported, "We assess with high confidence that Russian military intelligence, General Staff Main Intelligence Directorate or GRU, used the Guccifer 2.0 persona and DCLeaks.com to release U.S. victim data obtained in cyber operations publicly and in exclusives to media outlets and relayed material to WikiLeaks." Unlike the highly confident CIA and FBI, the NSA only had moderate confidence about Russian motives. Investigations into whether the Trump campaign actively colluded with Russians dominated American political life for the first 2 years of the Trump administration. It seemed odd that Trump, given his aggressive instincts and wrong-headedness on most foreign policy issues, repeatedly stressed his strong desire to improve relations with Russia. Some believe that his sensible inclinations toward Russia were a product of his corrupt business dealings with Russian bankers and oligarchs, or because of dirt that Vladimir Putin had and could use to blackmail him into going along with Russian priorities. Such speculation was fueled by a report cobbled together by former British spy Christopher Steele, who had first been hired to do opposition research by Fusion GPS on behalf of the Washington Free Beacon, a conservative website funded by hedge fund billionaire Paul Singer, and later by the Hillary Clinton campaign and the Democratic National Committee. Steele's first memo began, "Russian regime has been cultivating, supporting, and assisting Trump for at least 5 years. AIM, endorsed by Putin, has been to encourage splits in division in Western alliance. According to the memo, the Russians had provided Trump and his close advisers with a regular flow of intelligence from the Kremlin, which had enough compromising material on Trump to blackmail him, including perverted sexual acts which have been arraigned/monitored by the FSB. The memo goes on to describe Trump's hiring a number of prostitutes to perform a golden showers urination show in front of him, in a Ritz-Carlton hotel room bugged with microphones and concealed cameras by the FSB. These and other allegations have been the subject of a prolonged investigation by Special Counsel Robert Mueller and simultaneous investigations by several congressional committees. Mueller's investigation into the Trump campaign's alleged collusion with Russia has been thorough and meticulous. His investigators and the media have turned up numerous instances in which close Trump associates met with Russians during the campaign and then lied to the FBI and other investigators, resulting in criminal indictments, firings, recusals, lost security clearances, guilty pleas, and convictions. Mueller, whose probity appeared above reproach, seemed to be an ideal choice to lead the probe. He was a lifelong Republican, whom George W. Bush had appointed director of the FBI in 2001, 1 week before 9/11. Obama reappointed him for 2 more years when his 10-year term ran out in 2011. He was selected to serve as special counsel in the Russia probe by Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein, a Trump appointee. Rosenstein had inherited that authority when Attorney General Jeff Sessions recused himself after being caught lying about his own Russian contacts. Trump, who repeatedly disparaged Sessions for having recused himself, had actually deepened the crisis by firing FBI Director James Comey in an effort to undermine Comey's investigation into Trump's Russia-related improprieties. When Rosenstein appointed Mueller in May 2017, Politico wrote, "Mueller might just be America's straightest arrow, a respected, nonpartisan, and fiercely apolitical public servant whose only lifetime motivation has been the search for justice." Most of the media agreed, applauding Mueller as a man of unimpeachable integrity. Civil libertarians, however, might dispute that characterization. Following 9/11, Mueller covered up FBI incompetence in not preventing the attacks, which FBI Special Agent Harry Sammet testified represented criminal negligence on the agency's part. Mueller's obfuscations and deliberate distortions were crucial to passage of the Patriot Act, a massive assault on American freedoms. Following 9/11, he oversaw a roundup of Muslim Americans across the country. In Senate testimony, he gave credence to the falsehood about Iraqi possessions of weapons of mass destruction and warned that Saddam might supply such weapons to Al-Qaeda. During his tenure as FBI director, the agency was guilty of massive abuses of power. In 2011, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, EFF, released a report titled "Patterns of Misconduct, FBI Intelligence Violations from 2001 to 2008, based on 2,500 pages of FBI reports to the Intelligence Oversight Board that the EFF had obtained through FOIA requests, and concluded that FBI intelligence investigations have compromised the civil liberties of American citizens far more frequently and to a greater extent than was previously assumed. The scale of violations was vast. The EFF found that the actual number of violations that may have occurred from 2001 to 2008 could approach tens of thousands. The true extent of government surveillance under Bush, Obama, Mueller, and associates only became apparent in June 2013, when NSA contractor and former CIA employee Edward Snowden revealed the extraordinary reach of the intelligence community into the lives of ordinary citizens around the planet. Federal Judge Richard Leon described the vacuuming up of personal data as almost Orwellian. He said, "I cannot imagine a more indiscriminate and arbitrary invasion than this systematic and high-tech collection and retention of personal data on virtually every single citizen for purposes of querying and analyzing it without prior judicial restraint." As the investigation has dragged on, The more liberal U.S. media, led by CNN and MSNBC, sensing the opportunity to derail if not destroy the Trump presidency, have trumpeted the various allegations around the clock, placing a blind faith in the intelligence community that has surprised many of those who had lived through the Cold War and the invasion of Iraq. On the day the intelligence community report was made public, the New York Times' Scott Shane wrote, "What is missing from the report is what many Americans eagerly anticipated. Hard evidence to back up the agency's claims that the Russian government engineered the election attack. Instead, the message from the agencies essentially amounts to, trust us." Among the critics of the intelligence community report were former CIA, NSA, and FBI officials, some of whom were members of the Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, VIPS, which had been formed in 2003 to challenge the intelligence undergirding the invasion of Iraq. They questioned the rate at which material had been downloaded and copied from the Internet, and concluded that the material posted by WikiLeaks had been leaked, not hacked. VIPS thought it suspicious that the DNC did not have the FBI or other intelligence agencies examine the compromised Democratic servers, instead turning them over to CrowdStrike, a private firm with obvious conflicts of interest. Putin angrily denied the charges, pointing out how easy it would have been for someone to mask and camouflage such a hack. But the Western media impugned his credibility. In July 2017, VIPS sent a memo to Trump, questioning the intelligence community's findings and offering an alternative explanation of what happened, alleging, "The forensics reflect what seems to have been a desperate effort to blame the Russian for publishing highly embarrassing DNC emails 3 days before the Democratic convention last July." Mrs. Clinton's PR chief, Jennifer Palmieri, has explained how she used golf carts to make the rounds at the convention. She wrote that her mission was to get the press to focus on something even we found difficult to process. The prospect that Russia had not only hacked and stolen emails from the DNC, but that it had done so to help Donald Trump and hurt Hillary Clinton. Independent cyber investigators have now completed the kind of forensic work that the intelligence assessment did not do, and came up with verifiable evidence from the metadata found in the record of the alleged Russian hack. The VIPS letter to Trump also alluded to documents released by WikiLeaks that it labeled Vault 7. The documents revealed a stunning array of CIA cyber warfare tools, including an obfuscation tool that, according to the Washington Post's Ellen Nakashima, made it possible to conduct a forensic attribution double game or false flag operation in Chinese, Russian, Korean, Arabic, and Farsi. Several BIPS members, including Tom Drake and Scott Ritter, chose not to sign the July 24, 2017 VIPS memo and challenged its heavy reliance on questionable data transfer speeds. They wrote, "This VIPS memo could have easily raised the necessary and critical questions without resorting to law of physics conclusions that claim to prove beyond any shadow of a doubt that it was an inside network copy only, and then asserting the fact that the Russians, or anybody else for that matter, did not hack the DNC." One of the most interesting challenges to the prevailing consensus on Russian hacking came from George Beebe, the former CIA chief of Russian analysis and advisor to Dick Cheney, who told MSNBC that "the evidence out there suggests that Russia was probably involved in some way, but I'm not sure you can reach that judgment with a high degree of confidence based on the evidence we're seeing." He reminded viewers that it wasn't 17 intelligence agencies that unanimously agreed about Russians' role, but only three. And of those three, he continued, only a handful of hand-picked people were involved in reaching those conclusions. "That's not a very normal way of reaching intelligence conclusions. Having a hand-selected small group of individuals from a small number of agencies is irregular." He agreed with other experts who acknowledged, "It's fairly easy to obscure your identities in conducting these sorts of things." He said that the agency's conclusions were partly technical and partly educated guesswork based on who might have an interest in doing these sorts of things. He believed the Russians were involved, but wasn't convinced of the motives the intelligence report attributed to them. The IC assessment indicates that the reason the Russians were involved was simultaneously to help elect Donald Trump on the one hand, but also to undermine our democracy and to undermine what they call the liberal international order. Now, those are very strong statements, and they suggest a policy response on our part that would be designed to fight Russian efforts to destroy us. We haven't examined some alternative hypotheses, which are very important to consider. One is espionage, and the Russians have been very active in collecting information through cyber means about our politics, about what might be coming down the road in terms of policy, and in the case of these nuclear power plants, our critical infrastructure and the vulnerabilities that they might be able to take advantage of. That could serve as deterrence to our own cyber operations against Russia. Also, contingencies in the event that we were to find ourselves in a direct military confrontation. The second thing that I think they're doing is what you might call simply tit for tat. The Russians believe that we've been heavily involved in their domestic politics, and we've been active in those areas for many, many years. They've complained about this repeatedly. And I think that one of the things that they have an interest in doing is showing us that they can do the same things to us that they believe we've been doing to them. The U.S. government, he noted, has been very involved in Russian domestic politics since well back into the 1990s. The Russians recall very well what we did to support national referendums back in that time. We were actually instructing Russians on how we thought they ought to vote in their national referendums. Absolutely overtly. We were heavily involved in promoting then-President Yeltsin's re-election in 1996. So the Russians think we've been knee-deep in Russian domestic politics quite clearly, and they've objected to it. U.S. involvement in propping up the tottering Yeltsin candidacy in 1996 was so open that Time had a cover story on July 15, 1996, titled "Yanks to the Rescue, The Secret Story of How American Advisors Helped Yeltsin Win." And Hollywood produced a 2003 feature film, Spinning Boris, starring Jeff Goldblum and Liv Schreiber. Despite Yeltsin's single-digit approval ratings, disastrous war in Chechnya, and ruinous presidency, Bill Clinton decided to pull out all the stops and throw U.S. weight behind his Russian ally. Clinton knew he couldn't make a nominating speech for old Boris, but decided that we've got to go all the way in helping in every other respect. He later admitted, "I want this guy to win so bad it hurts." It was the Russian people, however, who would suffer, as Clinton arranged for the IMF to give Russia more than $10 billion in the run-up to the election, which Yeltsin, taking direction from American political advisors, strategically deployed to eke out a victory. Putin was especially incensed over the U.S. role in instigating a street demonstration in December 2011 that cast aspersions on the integrity of Russian parliamentary elections and on Putin's upcoming 2012 presidential bid. Decrying the use of hundreds of millions of dollars in foreign money to influence Russian politics, he accused Secretary of State Hillary Clinton of encouraging mercenary Kremlin protesters. "She set the tone for some actors in our country and gave them a signal. They heard this signal, and with the support of the U.S. State Department, began active work." "Pouring foreign money into electoral processes is particularly unacceptable," he said, anticipating what the Americans would accuse Russia of just a few years later, and stressed the need to work out forms of protections of our sovereignty, defense against interference from outside. In February 2018, the Justice Department indicted 13 individuals connected to the Internet Research Agency, IRA, a Russian troll factory in St. Petersburg linked to Yevgeny Prigozhin, a Russian oligarch known to be close to Putin. Beginning in 2014, the IRA had been spreading propaganda, some of which was meant to sow divisiveness in the U.S. and influence the 2016 elections. It reportedly had a budget of $1.2 million per month. Some questioned how much influence the IRA disinformation actually had on the election. Facebook reported that the IRA spent $100,000 on Facebook ads, only 44% of which was seen before the election. 56% came afterward. The Washington Post journalists who broke the story noted, "The ad spending from Russia is tiny relative to overall campaign costs." Others agreed with that assessment. Reuters put it in context. More than $1 billion was spent on political ads during the 2016 presidential campaign, thousands of times more than the presumed Russian spending identified by Facebook's security team. But the information was tweeted and retweeted, eventually reaching more than 100 million people. Among the skeptics was Adrian Chen. Chen had written a detailed account of the IRA in the New York Times Magazine in June 2015. Others had earlier reported on the troll farm and its operations, but Chen's article gave it new prominence. By late February 2018, he had seen its influence blown way out of proportion. He complained, "The Russians' efforts tend to be framed as a kind of giant machine, in which talking points generated by the Kremlin are amplified through a series of bots, fake Facebook pages, and sympathetic human influencers. The machine, we are told, is so sophisticated that only an expert can peer into the black box and explain to the layperson how it works." Chen wanted to withdraw from the club of experts who are getting rich by peddling exaggerated accounts of Russian influence. "I agree," he wrote, "with my colleague Masha Gessen, that the whole issue has been blown out of proportion." Looking back on his 2015 article, he reflected, "If I could do it all over again, I would have highlighted just how inept and haphazard those attempts were. The IRA," he insisted, "was not the savvy, efficient manipulator of American public opinion it was being portrayed as in the U.S. media by those self-serving experts." Chen's withdrawal from the club of experts left a vacancy that was happily filled by General James Clapper, the former director of National Intelligence, who cashed in big with the May 2018 publication of Facts and Fears, Hard Truths from a Life in Intelligence. Clapper wrote that he had no doubt that the Russians were responsible for Trump's victory. "Surprising even themselves," he stated with certainty, "they swung the election to a Trump win." Other experts, ranging from Republican Senator John McCain to California Democratic Representative Jackie Speier and Democratic Senator Jeanne Shaheen, repeatedly charged that Russian election meddling was an act of war. Representative Eric Swalwell, Democrat of California, said, "Our country was attacked by Russia." Senator Ben Cardin, Democrat of Maryland, ranking member on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, likened the attack to a political Pearl Harbor, a view echoed by New York Times columnist Tom Friedman. Hillary Clinton called it a cyber 9/11. Sanctions kept coming. In July 2017, Congress passed new sanctions on Russia, Iran, and North Korea. The House voted 419-3. The Senate voted 98-2. The Washington Post's David Ignatius wondered if an unthinking herd mentality was afoot in Washington. But months of unrelenting discussion of Russian election meddling in the major liberal media, CNN, NBC, MSNBC, New York Times, Washington Post, couldn't convince highly regarded election expert Nate Silver that the Russian troll farm played a significant role in Clinton's defeat. Silver tweeted on December 17, 2018, "If you wrote out a list of the most important factors in the 2016 election, I'm not sure that Russian social media memes would be among the top 100. The scale was quite small, and there's not much evidence that they were effective." He reasoned that the much-hyped 0.1% or so of social media messages sent by the Russian troll farms during the campaign was far too small to have a discernible impact. Silver further cited recent news coverage of a post-election Russian social media campaign to discredit Robert Mueller, based on 5,000 tweets, and noted, "That's nothing. Platform-wide, there are something like 500 million tweets posted each day." Such logic, however, was lost on American mainstream media. Numerous other factors contributed to Republican victories in 2016, in many cases more than Russian meddling, including Supreme Court rulings like Citizens United, which lifted limits on how much corporations and special interests could spend on elections, partisan gerrymandering, the influence of free-spending billionaires like Robert Mercer, Sheldon Adelson, and Paul Singer, Republican voter suppression, and intervention by other foreign governments, such as Saudi Arabia and Israel. Atop that list was the role played by Cambridge Analytica, a political consulting firm principally owned by hedge fund billionaire Robert Mercer, and headed by Steve Bannon, who resigned in August 2016 to lead the Trump campaign in the run-up to the November election. Among the firm's leading clients was a John Bolton-controlled super PAC. In 2014, Cambridge Analytica, without authorization, took the personal information of up to 87 million Facebook users, including 71 million Americans, through British-affiliated SCL Group, a foreign military contractor, and used that data to target voters with personalized political advertisements. Christopher Wiley, a former employee of SCL, explained the operation. "We exploited Facebook to harvest millions of people's profiles and built models to exploit what we knew about them and target their inner demons." In May 2018, Wiley informed the Senate Intelligence Committee that Bannon consciously sought to suppress voting by blacks and liberals. Wiley said the goal was voter disengagement, which the Republicans had been trying to do through various less sophisticated means for years. They had been assisted in this effort by Republican-appointed Supreme Court justices who struck down key provisions of the 1965 Voting Rights Act, which banned 9 states, known for racially discriminatory practices, from changing their election laws without federal approval. Wiley told CNN, "Mr. Bannon sees cultural warfare as the means to create enduring change in American politics. It was for this reason Mr. Bannon engaged SCL, to build an arsenal of informational weapons he could deploy on the American population." The Guardian gave an example of how this worked. Facebook posts were targeted at some black voters, reminding them of Hillary Clinton's 1990s description of black youths as super predators, in the hope it would deter them from voting. Sheldon and Miriam Adelson donated more than $20 million to the Trump campaign, with much going to pro-Trump super PAC Future 45. This was down from the $100 million-plus that the Times of Israel reported Sheldon Adelson had been ready to give Trump in May 2016. The Adelsons, the top Republican donors, had given $92.8 million to Israel-friendly candidates in the 2012 election cycle. In 2013, Sheldon called for pressuring Iran to give up its nuclear program by dropping a nuclear bomb in the Iranian desert. If that didn't suffice, he recommended something more dramatic. "Then you say, 'See? The next one is in the middle of Tehran. So we mean business. You want to be wiped out? Go ahead and take a tough position and continue with your nuclear development.'" The Koch brothers, whose billions had done so much to transform and corrupt the Republican Party over the years, decided to sit this one out, finding Trump too vile for even them to stomach. They were, however, close to Vice President Mike Pence, and have profited enormously from the Trump-Pence environment-destroying deregulatory measures and benefit-the-wealthy tax cuts. In August 2016, Donald Trump Jr. met in Trump Tower with George Nader, who represented wealthy Saudi and Emirati princes, Israeli social media expert Joel Zemel, and former Blackwater head Eric Prince, the international mercenary profiteer whose sister Betsy DeVos would go on to become Trump's Secretary of Education. Despite her manifest hostility toward the public schools that educate 90% of America's students, the New York Times broke the story about the meeting almost 2 years after it occurred, reporting that Zemel's company, which employed several former Israeli intelligence officers, had already drawn up a multi-million-dollar proposal for a social media manipulation effort to help elect Mr. Trump. The Times story did not report on any execution of the proposal, and Zemel denied that he or his associated companies went on to have any involvement in the campaign. The Times revealed that Donald Trump Jr. responded approvingly, and Nader was quickly embraced as a close ally by Trump campaign advisors, meeting frequently with Jared Kushner and Michael T. Flynn. The Saudis, Emiratis, and Israelis were all fervently opposed to Obama's nuclear deal with Iran, and would cash in with Trump in office. Trump and Hillary Clinton both addressed the annual AIPAC meeting in March 2016, each pledging to work with the right-wing Netanyahu government to counter the threats posed by Palestinian extremism and Iranian aggression. The previous year, hawkish Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu had been invited by congressional Republicans, not the White House, to address a joint session of Congress for the third time, the first foreign leader since Winston Churchill to be accorded that honor. In his speech, Netanyahu defiantly denounced the Iran nuclear deal that Obama and others had worked so hard to conclude. In a spectacle of bipartisan groveling rarely seen in the nation's capital, both Democrats and Republicans applauded endlessly at Netanyahu's thinly disguised display of contempt for Obama, whose weak-kneed opposition to Israeli West Bank settlement expansion was more than Netanyahu could countenance. The fact that Obama had approved a 10-year, $38 billion defense package did little to mollify the Israeli right's outrage. Outwardly, Netanyahu maintained a neutral stance during the campaign, having drawn criticism for his warm embrace of Mitt Romney in 2012. But with the Israeli public favoring Clinton, and more than 75% of American Jews about to vote for her, in light of a Trump campaign that pandered to anti-Semitic groups, Netanyahu, despite having worked hard to tether his government to the Republicans in recent years, knew better than to openly endorse either candidate. He met in March 2016 with Trump advisor Rudy Giuliani and privately, according to the former New York City mayor, expressed a clear preference for Trump, who was the darling of the Israeli right with his anti-Muslim rhetoric, and promised to move the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem. In office, Trump delivered on his promises, recognizing Jerusalem as Israel's capital, moving the U.S. embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem despite international protest, withdrawing from the Iran nuclear deal, increasing U.S. aid by $200 million, and repeatedly blocking U.N. actions hostile to Israel. Russian euphoria over Trump's victory quickly dampened, and a sense of business as usual sank in. Barely a month after Trump took office, New York Times Moscow correspondent Neil McFarquhar was already reporting on the changed mood in Moscow, where hopes that Trump would lift sanctions and fashion a different relationship with Moscow were quickly dashed. Since the inauguration, McFarquhar observed, it has become clear that Mr. Trump's rosy view of Mr. Putin is not shared by the president's top foreign policy advisers. Valery Solovy, who taught at Moscow State Institute of International Relations, echoed earlier comments by Putin when he stated, the overwhelming view of the Kremlin is that Trump is not very strong. He might have sympathy toward Russia, but he is contained within the political establishment. But others sensed that Trump's unpredictability was actually dangerous. Kremlin advisor Sergei Markov told McFarquhar, it would be better for us to have a predictable partner. An unpredictable one is dangerous. The July sanctions hit with a thud in Moscow, driving home Markov's point. According to Jeffrey Edmonds, the former director of Russia policy on the National Security Council under Obama, this dashed any hopes in the Kremlin of getting back to business as usual with the United States. Relations had declined so dramatically since 2012 that sober observers were worrying that the U.S. and Russia were in a new Cold War and warning about the risks of a hot one. Back in 2012, the main sticking point in U.S.-Russian relations was the controversy, relatively benign by today's standards, over U.S. plans to deploy missile defense in Europe. The differences over that issue didn't stop U.S. Secretary of Defense Robert Gates from visiting Moscow. When, that year, Mitt Romney called Russia America's number one geopolitical opponent, Obama mockingly declared, the 1980s, they're now calling to ask for their foreign policy back. Democrats applauded his derision. But since then, relations have nosedived with the crisis in Ukraine, the standoff over Crimea, the clash over Syria, and the confrontation in the Baltics and Eastern Europe. Things were further complicated by each side's accusing the other of cheating on the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces, INF treaty, which Trump later announced the U.S. would withdraw from. The treaty had eliminated an entire class of nuclear weapons, but pushed by John Bolton and Tim Morrison, Trump declared his intention to withdraw. Ambassador to Russia John Huntsman said INF was probably the most successful treaty in the history of arms control. And even more alarmingly, this raised the specter of another unrestrained nuclear arms race if the new START treaty is allowed to expire in 2021, as Trump has said it would. And then came the 2016 elections. Gates's successors, Chuck Hagel, Leon Panetta, Ash Carter, and Jim Mattis, have all declined to visit Moscow. After the Ukraine crisis broke, the U.S. largely ended military-to-military contacts, and the Russians halted cooperation on nuclear security. Former Georgia Senator Sam Nunn, who had been so heavily involved in the nuclear security effort, warned that the U.S. and Russia were in a race between cooperation and catastrophe, and catastrophe had the upper hand. The dangers are growing. Distrust between the U.S. and Russia, between NATO and Russia, is in a downward spiral. Nunn's Nuclear Threat Initiative, NTI, issued a report in late 2016, stating, Russia and the West are at a dangerous crossroads. During the past several years, we have been in a state of escalating tension, trapped in a downward spiral of antagonism and distrust. The threat of nuclear war between the two superpowers, it concluded, is now higher than any period since the end of the Cold War. The downward spiral continued in April 2017, when Trump accused Russia of complicity in a Syrian chemical weapons attack, and responded by firing 59 Tomahawk cruise missiles at the airfield from which the attack was launched. Despite the U.S. warnings to Moscow that the attack was about to occur, and the fact that no Russians were injured, relations worsened. Putin noted that since Trump took office, the level of trust on a working level, especially on the military level, has not improved, but rather has deteriorated. When Trump signed new sanctions legislation into law in August 2017, it was clear that Russian meddling on behalf of Trump had backfired. Despite Trump's continued refusal to personally criticize Putin, relations between the United States and Russia had reached the lowest point since the mid-1980s. Not only were sanctions not lifted as Putin hoped they would be, NATO troop deployments continued to grow, from 18,000 in 2014 to 23,000 by the end of 2017. Meanwhile, NATO members had increased spending by $12 billion. In early 2018, Brookings Institution Russia expert Alina Polyakova observed, "The climate is so toxic for the Russians, it has led to the exact opposite of what they would have wanted to see." That Russia chose September 11, 2018, the anniversary of the Al-Qaeda attack on the U.S. 17 years earlier, as the date to begin its biggest military exercises in almost four decades, might not have been coincidental. 300,000 Russian troops, 1,000 aircraft, and 900 tanks participated in Vostok 2018, Russia's biggest military exercise since 1981. Back then, the effort was aimed primarily at China. This time, however, China participated, with 3,200 People's Liberation Army troops, plus helicopters and military hardware, as did Mongolia for the first time. Chinese participation is particularly noteworthy, coming on the heels of joint military exercises by the two countries' navies in the Mediterranean in 2015, the South China Sea in 2016, and the Baltic Sea in 2017. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov told reporters that the exercise would be so massive because Russia's ability to defend itself in the current international situation, which is frequently quite aggressive and unfriendly toward us, is absolutely justified and has no alternative. Russian Defense Minister Sergei Shoigu described the operation, which he compared to a major World War II battle. 36,000 pieces of military equipment moving together at the same time. Tanks, armored personnel carriers, infantry fighting vehicles. And all of this, of course, in conditions as close to combat as possible. U.S. policy has driven Russia and China closer together than they had been for decades. As Pepe Escobar noted, Kissingerian divide and rule, splitting Russia and China, had failed. He pointed to evidence of Russia and China's intensifying strategic partnership. interpolating Russia-China geoeconomics, the concerted drive to bypass the U.S. dollar, the AAIB and the BRICS New Development Bank involved in infrastructure financing, the tech upgrade inbuilt in Made in China 2025, the push towards an alternative banking clearance mechanism, a new SWIFT, massive stockpiling of gold reserves, and the expanded politico-economic role of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, SCO. In June 2018, Xi declared, "President Putin and I both think that the China-Russia Comprehensive Strategic Partnership is mature, firm, and stable. It is the highest level, most profound, and strategically most significant relationship between major countries in the world." Putin described the level of relations between the two countries as unprecedentedly high, commenting that relations between Russia and China are at the best level in history, according to Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi. Or as Li Hui, China's ambassador to Russia, put it, "China and Russia are together now like lips and teeth." This was apparently as true on the personal level as on the political. Xi described Putin as his best, most intimate friend. Clearly,